case for today, Earls versus McNaughtry. Ms. Radner?
May it please the court. Petitioner Fairley Earls was denied his Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel because trial counsel's performance was deficient and prejudicial under Strickland. As a result, he was also denied his due process right to a fair trial. The district court's order denying his habeas petition should be reversed. Counsel's performance was deficient. He failed to redact a social worker's videotaped judgment about Earls' guilt after the court instructed him to do so, and after the state agreed that it would be appropriate. As a result, the jury heard the social worker tell the six-year-old girl that she was very sorry that Fairley did this to you, and we don't want him to do this to you anymore.
And she was 6 years old at the time of the events
involved? Yes, Your Honor.
How old was she at the time of trial?
It was 1 year later.
Thank you.
So she would have been seven. Counsel also failed to object to the social worker's testimony that the six-year-old girl was telling the truth.
Could we stop for a minute on the redaction? Because relating that to the state court's evaluation of these claims, which obviously is central, the state court thought that the failure to redact that one final or couple of comments, whether you call it one or two comments, in the light of the whole thing, wasn't so awful as to be prejudicial anyway, even if it was ineffective performance. Now, certainly this lawyer had no reputable explanation for why he failed to do this. Indeed, it's pretty amazing. But prejudice is part of the Strickland analysis as well. And the idea was just this is a very young person who was being talked to, and it was just kind of a reassuring sort of thing to say, and overall couldn't have affected confidence in the outcome. That's the kind of finding to which we're supposed to give deference, isn't it?
Your Honor, we'll look at the prejudice here. Strickland requires a reasonable probability that but for counsel's errors, the outcome of the trial would have been different. And we have to look, according to Strickland, at the totality of the circumstances of the trial. And we have to look at counsel's actions at the time that he made them at trial, avoiding any effects of hindsight.
Right, but I just want, I mean, if it's possible, I realize you're going to want to put all this back together again, which is appropriate, but this one action with respect to the redaction in the video was evaluated, at least on its own, by the state court as not so terribly prejudicial. The social worker testimony at the trial, maybe once you add that into the picture, you get more going on, since the social worker spends a fair amount of time talking about what a truthful young lady this was. But do you really think focusing only on the redaction, there's so much harm there that we have to surmount the AEDPA standards and say this was an unreasonable application of Strickland?
On its own as well, the failure to redact the testimony or the failure to redact the videotape judgment was prejudicial. Obviously, when the other testimony is coupled onto it, it's even more prejudicial. But looking at the trial, the six-year-old girl or seven-year-old girl at the time of trial testified. No other witness corroborated her story about the event. In fact, her testimony contradicted the overwhelming circumstantial evidence at trial. As a result, it was prejudicial because it infringed on the jury's right to evaluate witness credibility.
Under Wisconsin law, is the seven-year-old qualified? Does the judge inquire as to her ability to know right from her tell the truth, truth-telling capacity?
I don't believe that, from the record I've seen, I have not seen anything where the judge evaluated her credibility before.
We're talking about Wisconsin law, not the specific one. Does Wisconsin law require that children of, quote, tender years, whatever that might mean, have to be qualified, voir dired before by the court to determine whether or not they can testify truthfully, or they understand what the nature of an oath and so on?
I'm not familiar with any law in Wisconsin. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Are you familiar with the Illinois law on the subject?
No, I'm sorry.
Well, I'll enlighten you. It is required that the judge voir dire the witness and determine and make a finding that, in his opinion, she knows the difference between right and wrong and knows what the ramifications of lying might be.
Your Honor, I'm not saying that the girl testified and was lying.
No, the point is, and it's the same law in Indiana, so we don't know about Wisconsin, but those inquiries are made, and it's somewhat similar to the type of testimony that was received.
We need to go back here, I mean, focusing again on the prejudice here, we need to go back and look at the totality of the circumstances here. It is the jury's role to evaluate credibility of witnesses. In this case, when you've got the videotaped judgment saying that Earls is guilty, the jury loses its ability to evaluate because the jury here is told who to believe. And we know here, I mean, trial counsel ignored.
We can go back to make this analogy again. In this case, in the scenarios that Judge Bauer and I were discussing, the judge makes the initial determination whether the witness can testify, knows the ability to testify under oath, what that means, what truth-telling means. Isn't that similar to what's being done with regard to the social worker?
The social worker actually testified that the girl was telling the truth about her story. She actually used those words and said she was telling the truth. And then you've also got testimony here where you've got the mother, the father, the aunt, the uncle, and the grandmother all testifying that she is generally a truthful person. And then you've got the state emphasizing this testimony in its closing argument.
And your argument is Wisconsin law prohibits that sort of vouching.
It does in this case. And then on top of that, you've got the videotaped judgment where the court specifically raised the issue and told counsel to redact these because the court said she's apparently reaching a judgment here. And the state agreed that she was reaching a judgment and it would be okay to redact it. And counsel failed to redact it. So the jury hears this testimony, hears all of this testimony through the trial. Clearly, this testimony is prejudicial. I mean, there's a reason why the state asked
Who tendered the videotape?
The state tendered the video. There's a reason why.
Why didn't the judge ask the state to redact it?
At the pretrial hearing, that's where this came up, and the state specifically said it appears she's reaching a judgment, and he specifically asked Earl's trial counsel to redact it. And Earl's trial counsel said he was going to review it and see if there was anything else that he wanted to redact.
Well, but
and
if it's the state's evidence, why is it the job of the defense counsel to redact it?
Well, Earl's trial counsel at the time said he wanted to review the tape and see if there were anything else in there that he might want to redact. And then the court offered to hold another pretrial hearing to discuss these issues. And there was no other pretrial hearing on the issue.
Well,
and
it's not really relevant anyway.
The point is the tape came in, the jury heard these statements. These statements were prejudicial, and they undermine confidence in the verdict, especially when you consider the fact that the 6-year-old girl testified, nobody else corroborated. 7-year-old girl, I'm sorry. The 7-year-old girl testified, no other witness corroborated her story, and the overwhelming circumstantial evidence actually contradicted her story. So the prejudice here is almost self-evident.
How much was the time? Explain to me the timeline from the time of these events purportedly occurred until there was a discussion with her mother about this. Is that the first discussion with her mother?
Yes. The events occurred on Labor Day weekend of 1997. Approximately 10 days later, she mentioned something to her mother about that. In that 10-day gap, there was no mention of this. Obviously, this occurred at an event where there was a birthday party, there was a brat fry, there was a picnic, there were lots of people around, and no one saw anything. No one told her parents they saw anything.
Was there any indication how the discussion came about?
The discussion with her mother? Yes, her mother was giving her a bath about 10 days later, and she apparently had some redness, and her mother asked what happened, according to the record, her mother asked did anybody touch you there? And she said, if no one had touched her since Fairley had touched her.
Was the record clear whether the touching on the occasions that it occurred was over or underneath her clothes?
Based on the interview with the social worker, it appears there was some confusion, but it, and then based on the testimony at trial as well, it seems pretty clear that this was over the clothes and not under the clothes. So this testimony was prejudicial, and there's a reasonable likelihood, a reasonable probability, and that's what Strickland requires, that if trial counsel had objected to the improper testimony and had redacted the videotape, as per the court's instructions, the outcome of the trial would have been different. And as I mentioned, each one alone was prejudicial, but you've got the cumulative effect of all of this testimony coming in. All of this testimony is pervading the trial. It's part of every aspect of the trial.
And can I ask you a question whether your due process theory actually adds anything significant to this? Because that's where the state is pushing harder on procedural default. And, you know, there's, you know, it takes, particularly after Baldwin against Reese recently, fair presentment claims quite seriously, I just wonder whether this is really just another way of looking at the same thing, and it's really all encompassed in your ineffectiveness of counsel argument, or whether there's some independent reason that we would have to think of the due process claim.
Well, when we look at prejudice, it leads us to the due process violation. The prejudice issue we were talking about leads us to due process.
But, I mean, it would be encompassed in a Sixth Amendment analysis anyway, though, right? Because we think of performance, and then we think of prejudice, and prejudice certainly would reveal that that something that would undermine our confidence in the outcome of the trial, such as, you know, failure to raise a potentially serious claim had occurred, right?
The one just minor distinction here is that when we're looking at due process and we're looking at the fact that Earls was denied a fundamentally fair trial in violation of due process as a result of this improper testimony. And the admission of improper testimony to bolster a complainant's credibility can result in a due process violation. And the Eighth Circuit has addressed precisely that issue in the context of a habeas petition. And that case is Maurer v. Department of Corrections from the Eighth Circuit. And that case is very similar to this case. That was a rape prosecution case. And the state in that case elicited vouching testimony from four witnesses, and he asked each of these witnesses whether the victim seemed sincere when she alleged that she had been raped. And then he reinforced this testimony in his closing. And the Eighth Circuit found that the jury's credibility determination had been invaded, and that this was that there was a denial of due process as a result. And this case was, the Maurer case was very similar to this case, where it was very close. There wasn't a lot of corroborating evidence to the victim's story. And
you're into your rebuttal time, you know. I thought I'd tell you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Before you leap forward, and I lose track of my question, does Wisconsin require the judge to voir dire a child of tender age before permitting it to take the stand, he or she to take the stand?
It requires a voir dire outside the hearing of the jury.
Yes.
As part of the trial, the jury is sent out. I mean, I suppose.
But there is a voir dire of the child under certain ages.
Normally. There's no specific statute that says competence for a young child must be done prior to trial or prior to testimony, but it has to be done outside the hearing of the jury. And it's routine practice to do it, to send the jury out, put the witness on, ask the competency questions, bring the jury.
But that didn't happen in this case.
I'm sorry?
That did not happen in this case.
I didn't do the direct appeal. It wasn't raised on direct appeal. It wasn't raised in the habeas petition.
Are you familiar with the record?
I can't tell you.
Are you familiar with the record?
The parts of the record that are relevant to this case, yeah.
Well, it seems to me if somebody's raising an issue of
They're not raising competence, though.
They're raising an issue of due process.
Well, I don't
think they're due process is the entire record is an issue.
The only due process claim Earls raised in the district court was that the evidence of the social worker violated due process. That issue was procedurally defaulted in the state courts.
Mm. I don't think so. I mean, the redaction of the video and the failure to object to the truthfulness testimony might have been, but the failure to object to the social worker testimony is raised in the actual briefs, which Baldwin reinforces is where it needs to be raised, with a citation and discussion to Maurer, particularly in federal due process terms. So I'm not sure that there is procedural default in that particular aspect of it. I've looked at this pretty carefully.
I think definitely there is.
Why?
The issue of this.
Well, you have 15 pages? I mean, really?
Well, if you will know, what the Court of Appeals says is, and the key words or the key phrases in under Wisconsin law for this social worker testimony is Hazeltine and Romero. Those are the two cases, one dealing with expert testimony, one dealing with lay opinion. The Court of Appeals specifically says we do not need to address because Earl's attorney did not contemporaneously object, and so they consider it only as an ineffective assistance of counsel.
I know that's what they, but we're talking about fair presentment. Was Earl, in his briefs, raising the federal due process issue in the state courts, as is his obligation to do? Now, state courts sometimes don't choose to address issues that are properly presented to them. Every court might make decisions about which things need to be discussed and which don't need to be discussed. But if Earl presented it in his brief, according to Baldwin, that is enough for fair presentment, and there is no procedural default.
No, that's not true.
That
because
is true, actually.
No, it's not. If the state court affirmatively relies on waiver, that's a procedural default whether or not the issue is fairly presented. And that's exactly what happened as to the testimony from the social worker. The fair presentment argument goes to the redaction claim. In that case, it was not fairly presented because the argument in the state court was over the admissibility of the tape itself, not of which is
matter of state. I'm more concerned about that than I am about the testimony of the social worker.
The social worker's testimony, and I'll read you, it's in paragraph 4 of the
Court of
Appeals.
No, I have the court's opinion right in front of me, but just because the Court of Appeals said it doesn't allow us to go back and figure out what Earl was presenting, the Court of Appeals says in paragraph 4, because trial counsel did not object to this testimony at the time it was offered, we must decide the issue by using the ineffective assistance of counsel methodology. I'm absolutely aware that that's what the Court of Appeals
said. Well, and that
said,
to me is a procedural due process, is a procedural default of the underlying evidentiary claim.
It's not an evidentiary claim that he's making, though. He's making a due process claim.
I read their brief to try to present in this court a due process claim on the admission of the evidence itself. And that's what I'm saying is procedurally defaulted. Now, it is true that the ineffective assistance of counsel claim was not defaulted. But how do you prove deficient performance when the state court held under state law that the evidence was properly admitted? And that's where we are. The Court of Appeals did not.
But ineffective assistance of counsel, of course, amounts to cause for overcoming a procedural default as well.
Well, but if you default, that's true.
It does. I mean, so if
yeah,
the counsel is ineffective, if the counsel is your proverbial potted plant, then that is something that excuses what would otherwise have been a procedural default. And then
right.
You move to prejudice and ask whether, in fact, this testimony fundamentally, had the correct effect. I want to always be careful with the way I phrase
this, on the
outcome.
But the cause of procedural defect, the cause for procedural default is the same claim as Doyle was entitled to raise.
Well, they overlap directly. Considerably. I don't disagree with you there, but I'm just saying when you've had the ineffectiveness of counsel, it's also something that counts for cause in excusing the procedural
default. Oh, yeah, I agree with that. Under
so you can reach, by one route or the other, you can reach this due process argument, whether you want to think of it as the prejudice angle.
Well, I disagree with you there.
Oh,
I don't think so.
I mean, our court has talked about the different ways in which ineffectiveness of counsel affects
First of all, you've got the problem of the 2254 D1 standard and how that plays in.
Right, and
which we don't know yet.
The Court of Appeals has not given us one word of explanation as to why their confidence in the outcome of this trial is unshaken. It's a conclusory statement, not a word. I don't know why. I can't call them on the phone
based
and ask.
Based on what evidence now are we talking?
I'm looking at the opinion of the Court of Appeals of the State of Wisconsin, which says these errors do not shake our confidence in the fairness or outcome of the trial. And then they say over again in paragraph 6 about the testimony not violating Hazeltine and so on. They assume without deciding that it was error not to have objected. That error, however, doesn't shake our confidence in the ultimate outcome of the trial. Earls, therefore, was not prejudiced. Why doesn't it shake their confidence in the outcome? When paragraph 7 goes on to scold the state for the way it handled this and to say, you know what, if we'd had this on direct appeal, we probably would have decided differently.
Well, I disagree with that, but
well, that's what they say.
Setting that aside,
you don't need to sit here and read the opinion back and forth, but that is what they say.
No, they said it's very close, which doesn't mean it's inadmissible.
They said, we advised the state, however, that if the issue had been properly preserved for appeal, the outcome of the appeal on this issue may well have been different.
Well.
So, interpret it the way you want. I mean, it's not a favorable comment.
I agree with you there. It is not a favorable comment. But the question in my mind is, when you read the testimony of the social worker as a whole, what the prosecutor was eliciting here was whether or not the social worker observed the witness during the interview, during the taped interview, for indications that she was either suggestible, that somebody had coached her, or that she had made up the story. He never asked whether or not the social worker believed she was telling the truth.
Did she testify that she believed she was telling the truth?
I don't think she did. What she testified was, I looked for evidence that she was suggestible. She resisted suggestion. I saw nothing in the testimony that suggested that her mother had coached her.
How are we to interpret the statement? Question, was there anything that you looked for that you saw in Jay that would indicate that she was not being truthful? Answer, nothing that I noted at the time, no. And on. I mean, the
testimony
is in the brief.
That's right. That part of the testimony is in the brief. Prior to this, the prosecutor had gone through the social worker and said, do you have things that you look for during an interview to indicate whether or not the witness has been coached, is suggestible, is being truthful, made everything up? And the social worker testified yes and listed them out. So that question is a reference to those signposts that the social worker looks for, and I think it's fairly common practice these days.
She was testified as an expert.
That's right, she was. Well, there was some aspect of her testimony that was expert. She also had some direct evidence because she authenticated the tape. But, yeah, mostly it was expert testimony.
If you were redoing it, you wouldn't have put on those family members and other witnesses.
Well, under state law, he was entitled to do that because that was all reputation testimony. And under State versus Eugenio, which is the leading case in Wisconsin, if the defense calls the victim's testimony into question in the opening statement.
Did he?
Yes, he did. What the district court, the circuit court, on the post-conviction motion said, well, he didn't call her a liar, but he did everything but. And under State versus Eugenio, which and I think the Court of Appeals was correct in this, that allows the state to put in general reputation evidence, and that's
general,
all it was.
General reputation evidence over isn't quite on point when we discuss this sort of thing. Your Honor says she failed no difference between telling the truth and lying, yes. Why do you say that? Because they're raised in a Christian environment. I take her to Sunday school and tell her the difference between truth and a lie. And not only that, it's more important that Jesus knows she tells the truth and every word of him to tell. And realizing you as a parent, would you say generally she's been really truthful with you and others? Now that, my friend, is not reputation evidence. That's specific discussion of education and what she has observed. It is not reputation evidence.
Well, the prior question is, does she know the difference between telling the truth and lying, which goes to capacity?
But we're not discussing that. You were talking
that's
about
right,
reputation. This is
evidence.
Not reputation evidence, and so would that be admissible under the exception you're talking about? If you tell her, does she generally tell the truth? Is she a reputation of telling the truth? And the answer is yes. Yeah, that stands. But this one will go on much farther than that. We don't have... this is...
does she know the difference between telling the truth or lying? Now, he's entitled to bolster the capacity of the witness.
Why?
And his question, why do you say that? Well, I mean, I can understand that the defendant would not like the references to religion and so on.
Well, that's just...
Again,
we're not worried about what the defendant might like or not. We're worried about whether it's a matter of law. The jury's entitled to have that not be... of the problem.
That's true, but that to me is not testimony that the witness is telling the truth.
Well, generally, reputation for truth and veracity in a community is generally the standard. This is a little different.
Right, but under 405, it can be testified either by opinion as to general veracity in the community or reputation itself, which has to come, I think, from personal interaction with the witness, and that's the way these questions are couched. Do you know the witness? Does she generally tell the truth?
Do you believe her under oath? And the answer is yes, and then you shut up.
Well,
you don't say why do you believe that because she has a marvelous Christian background. I raised her to be a truthful person. That goes beyond reputation. That's very specific discussion bolstering the credibility of the witness. Improperly.
But it's not bolstering the credibility of the witness is not objectionable. It's
only improperly bolstering the
properly. That's
improperly.
Improperly is true. But I, in my view, that's mostly capacity evidence. I don't believe that there's any evidence in this record where
a witness capacity evidence. You could say that about a 55-year-old man. He was raised in a good Christian environment. You know, Jesus pays attention to whether he tells the truth or not. You know,
say
that about anybody. That's not.
Except that
capacity.
That's true, but again, if the capacity of the witness or the veracity of the witness is attacked, why is that objectionable?
Because the law draws very careful lines, as I think Judge Bauer was suggesting, between the appropriate ways to address reputation for truthfulness and capacity of a witness in ways that are inappropriate, precisely because we want the jury to be the ultimate judge of credibility.
But under state law, there was nothing wrong with this.
Well, state law is, the last I checked, subject to federal law. So it could be perfect under state law and still violate federal law, or it could be perfect under both.
But due process would have to require the objection, or the evidence itself would have to so infect the trial as to make it fundamentally unfair.
There you go. Yeah, that's precisely the question.
So.
Yeah.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Adler. 2 minutes.
Earl properly raised all of his due process arguments in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. If you look at page 18 of his Wisconsin Court of Appeals brief, and this is relating to the testimony of the social worker, he said that the improper testimony, and I'm quoting here, deprived Earls of his due process right to a fair trial.
But the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, as your opponent points out, said that it wasn't going to reach that because of the failure of the earlier contemporaneous objection.
Your Honor, he was still entitled to raise a due process, a federal constitutional due process violation in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. There was a cause for his failure to object at trial, and that was his counsel.
So there we go back to
object.
The cause and prejudice.
Exactly.
That's the way you're doing it.
And then in his Wisconsin Court of Appeals brief, he cited to the federal Eighth Circuit case, as I mentioned, Maurer v. Department of Corrections, a habeas case dealing with a due process violation. He then argued that the improper testimony infected the trial with fundamental unfairness, the improper bolstering of her credibility deprived Earls of his due process fair trial right. This is language necessarily implicating a due process violation. It was properly raised in the state court. And then the testimony of the five family members as to her truthfulness was also raised in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. And if you look at page 19 and page 27 of this Wisconsin Court of Appeals brief, first there's a section heading that refers to the repeated improper testimony for the based on her character of truthfulness, and it says that it deprived Earls of his due process right to a fair trial. Then it says that the error was sufficiently egregious to infect the trial with fundamental fairness and deny Earls due process. This language uses terms so particular as to call to mind a constitutional violation. These claims were properly raised in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. I also want to address the issue about the Wisconsin Court of Appeals finding that the testimony was that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals found that the truthfulness testimony was properly admitted. This court should follow its decision in Kossel v. Miller. And there, the court found that consideration of whether a rape victim's in-court identification of her attacker was admissible is a legal issue properly presented in a habeas petition. And that's what's going on here, just as in Kossel. Earls is seeking habeas relief, is not seeking habeas relief based on errors of state law. Just as in Kossel, he is disputing a legal issue, and that's whether admission of repeated improper testimony bolstering the 7-year-old's credibility and these videotaped judgments where the social worker specifically says that she's sorry that he did this to you and we don't want him to do this to you again, whether these infringed on specific constitutional protections. And, Your Honors, they did. And the district court's order denying the habeas petition should be reversed.
Before you disappear, is his first name really Fairly? F-A-I-R-L-Y?
Yes.
That alone would make you suspicious.
Ms. Radler, the court wants to thank you for taking the appointment and the excellent way you represented your client.
Thank you, Judge.
Case will be taken under advisement.